Welcome to Sate.
Okay.
A podcast about the foods that have shaped Malaysia. I'm Dr. Nobby Leong, scientist, food writer, and broadcaster.
And I'm Philip Gibson, photographer and treasure hunter.
And in this series, we explore the history, cultures, and cuisines of Malaysia, from the ancient lands of Southeast Asia all the way through to the creation of a modern-day nation. In today's episode, we take a look at sambal and the Portuguese invasion. So get ready to spice up your life, because it's time for Sate.
Okay.
I know that was two Spice Girls jokes back to back, but it is about chili today.
Yeah. I thought you were saying that to me almost off mic, but now I realize it's on mic.
In the last episode, we talked about the rise of Malacca in the early 15th century. Malacca became this massive trade empire in the region, following in the footsteps of Sriwijaya before it. In today's episode, we look at what happened to Malacca in the early 16th century, following the arrival of the Portuguese Armada.
Boo.
But first, let's take a look at our food of choice for today, our symbol that connects us to the past, and that is sambal.
Sambal.
Yeah, a lot of Australians in the 90s were perhaps calling it sambal. The first time I saw it on TV was iconic chef Ian Huey Hewitson use sambal on his cooking show, which I can't remember what it's called anymore, but it was like so popular in the 90s.
Right.
And I actually didn't know what he was talking about at first.
Not realizing that it was something that you've probably eaten 1,000 times
yeah.
At this point.
Okay. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, well, I mean, you're saying that with a pretty heavy Australian accent there, so that doesn't surprise me. It's
sambal.
Yeah. Anyway, for those of us that speak with a more British version of the English accent, one of many, sambal. I don't know how we would say that in received pronunciation. Sambal. I don't know. What was it, the rain in Spain? Anyway, Ian Huey Hewitson. Some kind of a name that is. It's almost Icelandic.
Well, no, he went by Huey. Oh, Huey's Cooking Adventures.
Oh, there you are.
That was the name of his program. So everyone called him Huey, but his name is Ian Hewitson.
Oh, right. So it's not some Icelandic Olaf Olafsson. Right,
no,
okay,
no.
Right. Anyway, getting to the point, it was introduced to the Australians in the 90s, but it was introduced to Southeast Asia when?
A long, long time ago. So for those that don't know, sambal is sort of a catch-all term to describe a range of chili-based foods across Nusantara. So most people would call sambal a chili relish or condiment.
Mm-hmm.
It is that, but it's not just that. Sometimes it's a dish in its own right, like sambal squid, sambal prawns.
Okay. Yeah.
Sometimes it's like a paste that you would add to dishes, other dishes.
Okay.
So I think it's broader than what people kind of give it credit for.
Yeah, the way you were describing it there, I was kind of like, oh, chutney, but then it's not, because you wouldn't really make like a vat of chutney to just sit there and eat liberally with potatoes. Maybe some people might, but I wouldn't.
No, I wouldn't either, but you know. So a few examples, nasi lemak, which is Malaysia's national dish, that consists of coconut rice and sambal on the side. So that's it being used as a condiment.
Yeah.
There's also nasi goreng, which is a type of Malay fried rice, where typically you'd probably add sambal to the rice as you're frying it.
You would get that beyond just Malaysia, though. This is one of these very much pre-colonial dishes that everybody had their version of fried rice, right?
Yeah.
Which is what nasi goreng means. Nasi being rice, goreng being fried.
Look at you go.
I know, almost fluent.
And then there's also, you know, sambal prawns, as I mentioned before. Sambal squid. There's some Peranakan would do like a sambal pork.
And Bella Chan features pretty heavily in this one, doesn't she?
Bella Chan, yeah. Can be added to sambal. So there are hundreds, if not thousands, of different varieties of sambal.
Right.
Some have red chilies, some have green chilies, some have both, some have belacan, some don't. Some are fresh. You just pound up the chilies into a paste. Others, you fry it off. So there's so many different varieties of sambal.
And so when we were talking about spices in the last episode, to keep throwing it back to our, as our listeners start to learn more and more about what makes Malaysian food, You asked me, I think, where chili comes from, and yeah. I said it comes from South America.
Yeah, and you got that correct in our game of Leong family spices.
Philip knows plants.
And I think that's what's interesting about sambal. It is so critically important to not just Malaysia, but also Singapore, Indonesia, Brunei, so many places across Nusantara. But the dish has probably only been around for about 400 to 500 years because it is from South America. And Nusantara never really traded with Central and South America in the same way that it did with India and China.
Did it ever? Was anybody traversing the Pacific?
No. So it wasn't until Spanish and Portuguese traders in the 16th century, during Europe's Age of Discovery, quote unquote, discovered the Americas, set up trading ports along the way, and then traded those around the world.
Right.
So chili's become part of now the global spice trade, if you like. It's not taking the same route as some of the other spices, but nonetheless, it is a spice. And if we remember from the last episode, in the early 15th century, Malacca was becoming a prominent trade empire and a big part of that global spice trade. But when you become so rich and so powerful as the Malaccan Empire were, you start to attract the attention of others. And this is how Portugal started to become important in Malaysia's history. Okay, so let's think about Portugal for a moment and let's set the scene at the beginning of the 16th century. The King of Portugal is King Manuel, and his empire is expanding because, as we mentioned, this is now the age of exploration when Europeans are starting to discover, oh yeah, there are other places around the world that aren't just Europe.
Yeah.
At the time, spices are worth a lot of money, and pepper in particular is being used as a currency. But Portugal doesn't actually have direct access to spices. They're probably relying upon Venetian middlemen and also Arab traders in order to get the pepper and whatever other spices they're trading. So the king is a bit stressed out by this scenario. He's sort of worried that he is reliant on other trade empires for something as vital as spices. He's worried that he's going to get locked out of the spice trade and maybe his economy is going to suffer as a result. And so he starts looking for a way to get a more direct access to spices. And so he turns to Asia.
So for a bit of backstory about where Portugal was at this point in time, they'd recently just defeated the Moors and gotten rid of them out of Iberia, where Portugal is situated. And at this point, the Portuguese were probably feeling a bit cocky and then decided to try and take over more trading posts in the North African coast. After this, they then decided to start going down the west coast of North Africa, around the coast of Morocco and Western Sahara. At this point, maps of Europe only extended as far as the Cape of Bojador, which is around about where Western Sahara is just now. There is a whole bunch of myths and legends around what was happening there, because the sand dunes along the coast of Africa there constantly are changing. So from a cartographer's point of view, incredibly hard to map. Early explorers also like to have the coastline at sight so that they knew that they could get to land should they come into difficulty. The problem with this part of the land is that the reefs extend about 3 kilometres into the sea, which even to a report from 2004, the Royal Navy still cannot guarantee that that area has been properly surveyed.
Wow.
So this is why Europeans did not go any further. However, the Portuguese were determined, and so they decided to go further out into the sea in order to get past it. They then continued further and further down the coast, but it should be reiterated that it took them from Cape Bojador to get to South Africa over 100 years.
Very determined.
Quite. At one point, I think one of the kings of Portugal got so pissed off with these navigators that he was a bit kind of like, right, you need to start surveying 100 kilometres a year, otherwise we're not going to get anywhere. This spice trade is happening and we need to start saving money here and we need more gold, etc.
I've had demanding bosses in the past, but that sounds particularly...
I think to navigate 100 kilometres of coastline a year in old sailing ships when you're fighting against all of these different kind of winds and what have you is a big ask for sure. So after 100 years of navigating down the west coast, they finally get to South Africa and they realize that they can turn a corner, and to their surprise, the Indian Ocean isn't landlocked and they can then go straight from South Africa onto India.
Where we have our spices.
Mm.
Okay, so with this now, the King of Portugal, who now at this stage, early 16th century, is King Manuel, he now has a physical way to get to Asia and then to get to the spice trade. And in 1510, he seizes Goa. which is part of India. So that was his first step. He then sends out ships to a variety of other different places across Asia, one of them being Malacca. So he doesn't approach Malacca with the intent of violence.
Okay.
Unlike what he did in Goa, he actually just sends a trade delegation first to Malacca in order to get some trade terms going on. So okay. At least that would be some sort of direct access to spices.
Mm-hmm.
However, the Sultan of Malacca, Sultan Mahmud,
mm-hmm.
hears how Portugal treated their Muslim counterparts in Goa.
Mm-hmm.
Very upset by this.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, he imprisons this trade delegation.
Right.
Portugal, the king, mm-hmm. finds out about this imprisonment and is pissed off himself and therefore sends an armada to retaliate. This armada is led by Viceroy Albuquerque.
Okay.
18 ships, over 1,000 men. They reach Malacca in July 1511 and they pretty much destroy the place. They are much more powerful in terms of their military than Malacca.
Right.
They already had intelligence on Malacca from previous trips over there, so they knew the layout of the land.
Yeah.
And so they launched their very highly successful attack on Malacca. They burn Gujarati ships that are stationed offshore. They bombard Malacca day and night by cannons. They set warehouses on fire. This is where people have their stock and that sort of thing.
I mean, yeah, to reiterate, Malacca would have been one of the biggest trading points in all of Southeast Asia at this mm-hmm. point in time.
Yep. The royal palace was burned and probably so was the Great Mosque. If not then at another point.
Mm.
And so Malacca falls to Portugal. The Sultan doesn't die in this fight. Sultan Mahmud and his family end up escaping and set up a new residence in Johor, what's now Johor. They're obviously not in a good place.
No.
They want revenge.
Quite understandably.
And the Sultan tries on at least 9 separate occasions to retaliate.
And reclaim Malacca.
And he does so unsuccessfully.
Poor bastard.
Yes. So Portugal has now successfully claimed Malacca for their own and tries to run it like a trade empire. And in doing so, Portugal becomes the first European power to establish a presence in the region. And it's really the beginning now of a centuries-long period of European influence, control, and colonization in Southeast Asia. It's a massive turning point for the region.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like if word got back to Europe as it did, other intrepid naval countries would have been sending boats trying to find their own way over that way. I think it's also probably good to consider having just gotten rid of the Moors, well, not just, 100 years prior, getting rid of these Muslim occupants of Iberia, there was quite an anti-Muslim sentiment from these Portuguese at the time.
Mm.
And at this point, Islam was very, very embedded into Southeast Asia, certainly Malaysia and Indonesia at this point. So I could imagine that would have not gone down well, as you say, with the Muslim leaders for all of these other sultanates that existed around that region, from Aceh to Johor to even back to Palembang, which still existed at this point.
Mm.
They would be under no inclination to trade with Malacca any longer.
No.
Why would they?
Yeah, I mean, well, that's the thing. So Portugal managed to capture Malacca, but they can't actually capture the same prestige and they can't attract the trade that the Malaccan Empire had. And that's because they just kicked out the Muslim leaders, replaced them with Christian leaders.
Yep.
And the rest of Southeast Asia, who are also Muslim, don't like this.
Yep.
So they end up not really trading with Portuguese Malacca much.
Yeah, you're probably not going to be inclined to trade with the invaders, are you?
No.
Oh, those guys are dicks. Maybe not. And word will definitely get around between all of these other trading points just to kind of embargo.
Yeah. I think there was a lot of religion-based embargoing happening at the time, which weakened Portugal's attempts at establishing Malacca. They also don't really like the way that Portugal is running Malacca from an administrative point of view.
Right.
It's messy. Their governance is a bit rubbish, apparently.
Mm-hmm.
Policies aren't clear. They're inconsistent. They're not predictable.
Right.
All these really, really boring things that make trade empires great, Portugal doesn't have that.
And it's worth saying as well, that Malacca was very dependent on international trade for its own sustenance as well as a trading port. So Java was sending routinely thousands of tons of rice every year in order to feed the population of people that lived there. So if those ships from Java aren't coming, where are people getting their rice from? Because they're not growing wheat over there.
Yeah.
So where are the staples coming from?
So with Portugal establishing a presence on the Malay Peninsula, it ends up being there for quite some time, such that we do have a legacy of Portuguese influence on the culture of Malaysia today.
Mm-hmm.
So last week we talked about Peranakan culture and how sailors from particularly China and India would come to Malacca, settle, and then marry local Malay women. And this gave rise to new hybrid cultures like Chinese Peranakans, like Malacca Chetties.
Mm-hmm.
And now we can add a European Peranakan to this list. And this is Malaysia's Eurasian community.
I see.
So today we're just going to talk about one, and that's the Portuguese Eurasian community, also known as the Cristãos. And so Cristãos comes from the Portuguese word cristão, meaning Christian. So you can see just how important religion was to the Portuguese Empire at this stage.
For sure.
So the community arose during Portuguese Malacca's reign as a result of, again, mixed marriages between Portuguese sailors and local Malay women. And this gives rise to a really unique culture that does combine Portuguese religion, Christianity, with the culinary traditions of Portugal and the Malay world, as well as a combination of language.
Okay, yeah.
So, Philip, did you know that Malaysia had a Eurasian community?
No, I would have thought that the ruling classes, being the white Europeans, would have probably stuck to their own kind. Mm. I would have thought that there would have been a bit of white supremacy going on there to kind of reinforce that they were the rulers.
Yeah, yeah. I'm sure there were people like that.
I imagine.
So I do have some cousins that are Eurasian.
Okay.
But it's not a culture that I know that much about. Mm-hmm. So to find out more, we spoke to Melba Nunes. Melba Nunes, I would call her custodian of Cristãos cuisine.
Right.
She is a chef, cookbook author, and just a really lovely person.
Mm.
We met her at her house in KL for one of her supper clubs that she runs regularly.
Mm-hmm.
And she told us the story of her Cristãos childhood and where the culture is at today.
So this is my spot. One day it's going to open up. It's going to open up and then swallow me. Philip is looking there. Yeah. So this is where I do my cooking. I'm Melba. Melba Nunes from Malacca. I was born in 1953, so that would make me 71. My father was a government servant, Garden City. I don't know if you've heard of that. Now it's a city that's gone because they've taken away all the government quarters. Mm. And built like apartments and condominiums and all that. So I was born there, and in that area we had many Eurasian families. You see, way back in the 50s, 60s, so there were many Eurasian families. Then they migrated to Australia. Many of them intermarried. So I myself married an Indian anyway. But growing up there, yes, we felt the Eurasian community, everything, because the settlement was nearby, a Portuguese settlement. Then my mom, we are in the center. We are typical Eurasians, you know, and we had many Eurasian families back in the old days. Sad to say it's no longer.
So who are the Cristãos then?
All right. First of all, you know, when the Portuguese went to Malacca, they got married to all the local women there. They were men, you know, so they married the Chinese, the Nyonyas, Malays, Indians. I think mostly was Nyonya and the Malays. Mm. Because our food have got a lot of sambals and chilies and all. Everything is so rempah-based, paste, you know. All made from scratch.
Mm-hmm.
So that is what I think Cristãos food is, because the influence comes from the Portuguese, of course, you know, with their stews and their non-spicy stuff. And then you get the Malays with their sambals and all. Then you get the Indians with the Indian curry, some of our curries. All of our curries have got Cristãos names.
Mm.
So it's like curry seku. The word seku means dry.
Yeah.
It has the Indian spices in it. Whereas the rest, no. Every curry would have a name, a Cristãos name. and the ingredients, the rempa, the paste, is all made from scratch.
Melba shared with me life growing up in Malacca and the unique food traditions that she grew up with.
And the people were nice, you know. They were very happy knowing Eurasians at that time. And Kristan people, they used to... Like Christmas, for instance. Our doors will be open, Philip, no? There's no such thing as, oh, I must invite you to come and cooking this. No such thing. On Christmas morning, you will find the doors are open. You come in, not for a meal, to eat cakes, tarts, cakes, whatever, biscuits and whatnot. And those days, it was the seaweed jelly that was the most... the seaweed from the sea. Have you heard of that, Philip? That you can't get anymore. You can't. People say, can you? I say, cannot. No, no way. I can make it, but I can't get the seaweed. It's very tedious to clean it, to cook it.
Well, you used to make the agar-agar from scratch.
Oh, yeah. Wow. From the sea, the fishermen come and they sell you the seaweed. Yeah, and then my mom, of course, will know how to wash and take away all the shells and bits of dirt that's in it, soak it, and then start boiling it for hours. And with gula batu, you know, rock sugar. Yeah. So, and then you kind of bring it down to very little. The color has to be like a whiskey color or brandy color. Then it's perfect. So when you cut it, it's super sweet. But very, how do you say, like a sticky kind of feeling, you know? But it's very nice. Yeah. It's really very nice.
It
feels
like it's like a lost art to make.
It is. It is. Another one was bluder. Have you heard of bluder? No. The Dutch also have something similar. They have this kind of a cake pan with a ring in the center.
Okay.
Have you seen that?
Oh,
if you what do you call it? I can't remember the name
now.
The
cake with the hole in it.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah,
ah, yes. Yes, we use that kind of a mold to make a toddy cake called bluder.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So interesting.
Toddy cake. What's the toddy?
Toddy. Toddy is from the, you know, the one. Ah, the drink?
The drink.
Yeah. You had it?
Yeah.
Did you like it?
It was different.
I don't like it. Anyway.
So
but
you made a cake out of the toddy?
Yes, yes. Oh. Because that acts as yeast. It's like a, you know, ferments. Yeah. So it's very, very lost also now.
Yeah.
I try to get toddy now and again, people ask and all, but it's so tedious, you know, nobody, and then in the end, you know, you get so fed up because you have to wait for the thing and then, I think it's too much trouble.
Yeah.
But if I were to try and like to preserve it, to show some, maybe I would.
Yeah, maybe do it once, film it.
Something like that, you know,
You mentioned Christmas was a time where
beautiful.
You had open doors so anyone
could just come in. Neighbors
were
all
strangers?
Sure. No, they were all our neighbors.
All
we
neighbors.
Knew everybody, you know, because we lived in like government quarters and it's all like in a row. And you find people, you know, all, you know everyone. And they were so happy to come, you know. And especially they knew my mum was a well-known cake person, she used to cook and all that. So Mercy, everybody called her Mercy. Her full name is Mercedes. So Auntie Mercy's house or Mercy, everybody will be so happy because she makes beautiful cakes and tarts and all. But these days, I don't think she could compete with anybody. In my time, we never worked at Nobi. You know, my mom never worked. I never worked because we were home people. And, you know, it was easier in that way to learn and do what you wanted to do, at home. Yeah. Make the rempas every day. Mom will, you know, we have that grinding stone, the big one. Have you seen that, really? No, that's the Indian one.
Oh. Is it the rolling?
Correct. Giling batu lah, we call it. So it's like a rectangle and with a anak, we call it like a... So every day, can you imagine, to make one curry, mom will do one rempa. So you come back from school, you know, okay, there's ambila today or there's devil or just one curry, one vegetable, one fish. It sort of complements, the dishes complement one another.
Yeah. For Melba, food was always a big part of her life. But it was only after her husband retired that she got into the restaurant business.
So I left Malacca in 72 when I got married and went up to started my married life in Klang. You know Klang, right? And then from there, my husband was transferred to other states. So we were up in Penang and Alostar and everywhere until we decided to come back to Kuala Lumpur to settle here because we had grandchildren to take care of. Yeah, and that's when I actually started, you know, I had a restaurant, right?
Mm-hmm, yes.
My daughters got together and wanted to make this little dream of mine come true. Yeah. I always wanted to have a little cafe. Mm. You know, I like people, so I enjoy cooking and entertaining. So my girls got together and said, let's open up the restaurant for her. And it was a restaurant, all right, not a cafe.
Yeah,
yeah, so it was in Bangsasao.
Oh, right.
Yeah. Yeah, so unfortunately, we closed in after 6 years because my daughters were migrating to Australia. Oh, yeah, right. So no choice, you know. Yeah. I'm not a money person
per se.
I'm more kitchen,
yes,
onions and chilies and whatnot. Yeah. So we decided to close the business. And it was at that time that YTL, you're familiar with YTL? Majestic Hotel in Kuala Lumpur?
Oh, yes.
They have one in Malacca as well?
Oh, yes, another one.
Yes. And so they offered me and they gave me the opportunity to actually run their restaurant there, or rather to work for them. And they only had one restaurant called The Mansion. Mm-hmm. So they gave me, for me it was an honor really, yeah, because it was like Melba at The Mansion,
wow,
serving only Kristang food. Yeah. Because I guess they thought that, you know, being from, I'm from Malacca, a Eurasian, so what better person they would have thought for me to serve. And I did pretty well. Unfortunately, when I joined Majestic, my husband passed away. So that took a toll on me. I had to leave, go away and grieve, decide if that was what I wanted to do. Mm-hmm. And I went back to complete my 2-year contract with them. And then decided that I wanted to be home.
In 2014, Melba published a cookbook called A Kristang Family Cookbook. But there aren't many chefs like Melba, and now Kristang culture is on the decline.
But I think it's on the decline because honestly, I want to open up a restaurant. Yeah. I'm just dying to do that again, you know, because I want to leave this.
Yes.
It's a legacy I want to leave. I'm not going to be here, well, you know, so soon. I might just go. But if I can train people and leave this, just this, Kristang food, I think it'll work, don't you think?
I think so.
Okay, great.
Why do you think it's on the decline and not thriving as much?
Because there are no restaurants. Unlike the Nyonyas, the Chinese, the Malays, you go everywhere, you get a restaurant that is very Nyonya, very... So many, you have choices. Where are we?
Even with her efforts to publish a Kristang cookbook, she said it's not enough to preserve the cooking culture.
They don't know the flavors.
Yeah.
Even if you follow my recipe, right? I poor thing. I don't know how my devil curry turned out.
I liked it, but as you said, I don't know if I made it correctly. Did I make it the way it's supposed to taste? Because
you're right.
The chilies I use are different to the chilies you've got in Malaysia.
Yes. You're right there. So it's actually difficult.
Yeah.
That's why I want to have a restaurant so that I can leave the kind of food I know. You know. And everybody can enjoy it the way that I remember eating it and cooking it.
While her desire to open a restaurant and keep her culture going is alive and well, the means aren't necessarily there. And so the practical aspects of preserving culture become a lot more of an issue. And as it so often does, it boils down to money.
So there's no, like my book, for instance, to get it printed, published was not easy. We did it on our own. Luckily, we had the means. That's why if I open a restaurant, also, I need to have people with the money and the means and the know-how of how to get around the... Because it's not so easy. You even to put up a signboard, you need certain criteria, certain... You cannot simply go and put Mel or Melba's or whatever. For sure, I can, but I don't have the means. I don't have, you know, and we need investors and whatnot for that. For setup, I can teach, I can be there. I can try the food and tell them, no, it's not like that, you know, or it should be like this, you know, or something like that.
and that was Melbourne Nunes, chef and cookbook author. Philip, what did you make of her interview?
Yeah, no, I mean, she was such a lively individual at 71 years older.
Mm.
She was very maternal, I think, in the way that she conducted herself and the way that she wanted to kind of spread this stuff. And she understood the kind of the joy of her foods as a way of preserving her culture, I thought was really, really obvious.
I think what's interesting about Kristang culture in Malaysia is that unlike some of the other cultures that we've talked about, I do think Malaysians know about the Eurasian community and they know about the Portuguese community because Malacca still has a Portuguese settlement where people live, and a lot of like tourists like to go there as well.
Mm.
But I don't think they really understand the depth of the culture.
Yeah, I mean, when we went out to the Portuguese settlement just to try to go to one of the restaurants to try a couple of these dishes prior to interviewing Melba. But I think we found that a lot of the food that was on offer was just Malaysian food, for want of a better word.
They do sell Kristang food, but a really small part of it.
Right.
So at a lot of these restaurants, you can get devil's curry, which is probably their most iconic dish.
Right.
It's a really, really spicy curry that the pungency just keeps building in your mouth.
Yeah, there's a saying apparently that where a Kristang person shits, the grass dies.
yeah, which, I can believe it.
Yeah, and you know, thank you to the Portuguese, I guess, for introducing chili to their diet, but you can obviously tell that they took the chilies with them everywhere, given how potent this food is.
Yeah, and at the Portuguese settlement, you could also get baked fish, another iconic Kristang dish. But you can't really get the other stews, the roast, the baked goods.
Right.
Those Kristang Christmas dishes, you can't really find them in many places. Melba mentioned a few off record. So you can still go to the Mansion, which does have her Kristang menu. And the Mansion is based in Malacca.
Right.
And there's also a Kristang restaurant in Singapore called Quinton's and one in KL, Kuala Lumpur, called Kumi. So there's really not many opportunities for Malaysians or visitors to experience Kristang culture.
Yeah, only marginally better than the Chetty Malaccan's one restaurant in all
of
Malaysia.
Yeah.
It's and I thought that was such an interesting point, that it's all very well that you can buy a cookbook, but you don't know when you're making it if you're making it right, because you don't have a taste memory to go back to.
Yeah.
Or a flavor memory, I guess. And I think that's a really important point that she made, which then, like, you know, made me think, for all of the previous people that we've interviewed, and certainly all of the people that we went on to interview, is that how on earth can you replicate this if you don't know what it's supposed to taste of?
Especially, I think, with things like stews and curries, where if you use the wrong chili, it might not be as spicy as it's supposed to be, for instance.
And the tears should be streaming out of your eyes when you eat this.
Yeah, yeah. And if you kind of have spices that are really old and aren't so potent, you're going to get something different. But you're not going to know that's wrong. So the other places that you can actually get Kristang food from is from Melba herself, which is mental.
Right.
So Melba Nunes, she does run supper clubs. You have to contact her in advance through social media or WhatsApp. But the fact that if you're in KL, you can just like ring up a custodian of Kristang cuisine and have her cook for you, or you can like buy cakes from her.
Yeah.
That to me is crazy.
Yeah, let me slide into Paul Hollywood or Mary Berry's DMs and see if I can get some of get them to cook me dinner.
Yeah. Like, you say that as a joke, but that is the British equivalent. Like, Mary Berry, she is the custodian of certainly British baking, if not British cooking in general.
I would say so.
And imagine if you could just hire her to do an afternoon tea.
Certainly a matriarch of it.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, that is, I think, the best kind of analogy I can think of, given Melba's kind of like esteemedness with her age and experience. And I would encourage anybody to do it, because you will just be entertained and you will be in stitches laughing, I think, at her dinner table.
Yeah.
She is so many anecdotes, so many great stories, and just a really, really loving and maternal person, I think. And it comes off so easily. No, I rate Melba really highly.
Yeah. I think this is what frustrates me about aspects of our food culture today, where people pay attention to something that's Instagram worthy. People pay attention to the Michelin guide.
Right.
But here you have someone like Melba Nunes, whose cooking is so deeply connected to her heritage,
right,
deeply connected to history, and is delicious, but we're sleeping on her.
Right. I mean, she gave us a tour of her kitchen, and she's got all of these handwritten recipes that are just literally kind of like blue tacked or like pinned up to you know, the back wall where she's cooking all this food. And, you know, if she's having people over for dinner, then, you know, she'll be cooking this stuff days in advance. Like, you know, it's no small feat for her. Like, it's a big deal. And, yeah, just, no, what an experience.
Yeah. Obviously, not everyone lives in Malaysia.
That is true.
So definitely go out and get yourself a copy of A Kristang Family Cookbook by Melbourne Nunes. And I believe it's actually one of only perhaps two Kristang cookbooks in the world.
All right.
So they are such an important resource for now and into the future for Kristang culture.
Yeah, no, I mean, it strikes me again, like what we had with the Chitty Malakans last week about, you know, these books have to exist as references, particularly when these cultures are possibly on the cusp of dying out.
If you're enjoying this episode, you can follow us on social media at SateOK. We'll be sharing beautiful photos taken by Philip of Malaysia, its people, and of course, the food. We'll also share photos of Malaysia from the archives, so you can see how the country has changed over time. You can also find links to give us a tip or donation to show your appreciation for the work we're doing. So head to our socials at SateOK or visit our website, sateok.com. Cuisine, of course, is just one aspect of culture. And for Kristang communities, there's also the language. So the Kristang community have their own Creole language, which is also Kristang. And we wanted to find out a bit more about this language and efforts to maintain it and other aspects of culture into the future. So we went to Malacca and we spoke to Martin Thesira, who is the president of the Malacca Portuguese Eurasian Heritage Arts and Culture Society. We joined Martin and other members of the Kristang community for one of their regular language meetup sessions.
There's no such thing as we speak ancient or antique Portuguese, no. Ours is a thriving language that is still evolving and it's
ongoing.
Yeah, it's like any other language. It is as original as possible. We have our own grammar.
Unsurprisingly, the Kristang language is on the decline. And as early as the 1960s, the community came together and recognized the need to preserve their unique language and culture.
When did it actually start going down? It actually started many, many years ago. Mm-hmm. Okay, you see, we talk about the Malacca Portuguese Cultural Society, 1966, 1967. That was actually the, how should I say, the emergence of the community's passion to save the language. Other than that, it was like, it was just drifting. Yeah. Then when he came to the picture, he set up the society. That was when that real, wow, we have to keep our cultural dances. We must start speaking the language. Renaissance of that. But it lasted for a couple of years. I think after 5 years, it just went down.
One of the reasons for the decline of Kristang language and community in general is major changes to the landscape. Traditionally, a large part of the Kristang community lived along the shore, around a road called Prior Lane. Fishing is a major part of the community, and much of the lifestyle was based around the ocean. However, in the 1970s, land reclamation projects began across Malacca. One of the major areas impacted was Prior Lane. Land reclamation saw the shoreline shift much further out. This development displaced local communities and disrupted traditional ways of life, like fishing. Martin was one of the people that used to live on Prior Lane.
And after all, I lived here, and this was actually a former enclave, or in fact, the last historical enclave of the community. You see, it was thriving, if it's say 20 years, 30 years, or not 20 years or not, 30 years ago, when the seafront was here, it was a thriving community. I mean, he grew up here, Mona grew up here. We grew up here, it was thriving. We had lots of kids running around, the seafront was there, we swam in the sea many, many times, we had festivals in the sea, we had the procession in the sea. Oh, we had so much activities here. And the community was like so close-knit. Very, I say, multiracial. Got Chinese, Indian, Malays, Indians. We lived harmoniously, but majority was Kristang. Okay? So over the years, like I say, after the reclamation came in the, say,
84,
in the 80s, people started to move out. Worst thing, when the government came in the announcement that they wanted to acquire this street to build an access road to Pulau Melaka, the new reclamation area. More so people got better, then they moved and bought elsewhere. But you see, that was all empty, vacant. Some out for rent, some even just left like that. So it's sad. So our aim actually is just to bring some activity, and this is one of it.
Today, the need to preserve the language has become incredibly urgent, as the number of native speakers in Malacca has plummeted.
How many people speak in Kristang now?
Okay, frankly speaking, if you see on record, it's 3,000. No. I think what is really, speakers of Kristang, I think it's less than 1,000. Less than 1,000. It's really endangered. My main focus is always on the fishermen. For me, they are the real custodians of the language. The real custodians of even the festivals. San Pedro, good example. You hear them speak. If they are among themselves, anything, any age group above 50 or so, you witness more or less. They will be speaking in their own lingo. Among themselves, above 50 especially. The moment one Chinese fishmonger, no discrimination here, he comes, he starts bahasa, everybody speaks bahasa. You get a young fisherman coming, speak English, all speak English. This is the danger. So I keep telling our senior fishermen, try and keep the language, especially among yourself, even if anybody come, continue with the Kristang language, because they are the real custodians. They are the only ones who speak on a daily basis among themselves. And even when they go home, among the family. Because the fishing community, like I say, are the ones that, for me, are the real custodians of the language, of the customary practices, of the festivals. So that is the very important segment of the community that have to be given focus.
In order to revitalize Prior Lane and the Kristang culture, the community started Malacca Portuguese Eurasian Heritage Arts and Cultural Society. Part of their work is to host Sunday sessions, where members of the public can come along to learn about Kristang language and culture. It was here that Martin taught us a few basic Kristang phrases.
So, some people say kisoti. That is maybe like among friends or fishermen. It is not so formal. Kisoti. But I think more proper is kinobas.
Kinobas.
Hello, how are you? Like, or even can be novice, also can be news.
News.
Kinobas. What is the news? Kinobas. How are you? Like. And then, okay, one more is Bong Pamiang. Direct translation, good morning. Bong Pamiang. Bong Atadi, good afternoon. Goodbye, in Portuguese is adios.
Adios.
Adios in Portuguese. So I will not say adios. I will always say encontra ditona. Encontra ditona. So, okay, there is till we meet again. Okay, encontra ditona.
Martin also taught us about music and some famous musicians that sing in Kristang. Some of these Kristang songs can be found online.
Yes, Kristang songs we have. But sadly, of late, not many new songs being composed. People like Joseph, people like Joe Bosco, he had his own album. I think he did about 20 new songs. New songs, huh? The other guy is Mr. Noel Felix. Okay, Mr. Noel Felix, more or less, was a very active member of the Portuguese Cultural Society in the 60s. And then he went on having his own group, Kutopari Malacca, and then, he's also another iconic cultural leader in that sense. And then prior to that, there were people like Rosil de Costa.
Unfortunately, convincing others in his community to learn Kristang isn't easy. It's become a particular issue when trying to bridge the gap between older and younger generations.
Are the youths coming and wanting to learn? Is that new desire, you know? Frankly speaking,
no.
Yeah.
Maybe 10%, 20% at the
most. No real interest. The interest is more outside.
Yeah, no.
The interest is more outside. It's people like you.
Correct.
No, true.
Correct.
You are here. Right. You tell me where is our, it was posted. That value or the urgency or that passion in wanting to keep. It's people like you. And it's, in truly, frankly speaking, if the day that this language disappear, wow. I mean, it's fine. It's parcel of our cultural fabric.
Yeah.
Imagine if we can't speak the Creole. If say our grandfathers all ran away and then became other and spoke other languages. We will not be what we are today. We cannot call ourselves a community because we don't have our own language. You know, so it's so important.
The Sunday language sessions aren't the only activity that Martin is undertaking. He's also documenting conversations between native speakers and using theatre to promote the language.
I want to do this. I want to maybe even make a competition for the best speaking fisherman in Kristang. And later also do a play, a simple play, Kristang. I will start with a comedy sketch or just a conversation between fishermen. Talk about your daily experience today at sea. And the way they express, that's the way it should be. Not static, not so like, you know, it should be the way, so expressive. If you really hear families quarreling in Kamu Portuguese between neighbors over the fence, my goodness, all kinds of bad words, all kinds of swearing. That is something I tell you, I want to really look into and record. That you cannot get, it's disappearing because the native speakers are going. Okay, you just ask any young, ngopi ritual. Mona, ngopi ritual.
Heavy rain.
Okay. I think you ask maybe anybody, maybe the below 30, 40, they don't know what it means, ngopi ritual. Actually, it translates to one lake of rain.
If you translate it to English,
Unga, one, pale, lake, chua, ritual. Ngopi ritual, one lake of rain. It doesn't make sense. But any old native speaker, they know it's a heavy shower coming. Press on the rope, ngopi ritual today. Quickly carry your clothes. Lake of rain is coming. Heavy shower is coming. So that's what I mean. And to get this recorder is so important because these kind of people are disappearing fast.
Currently, it's a small group of people that are working together to preserve Kristang culture. But hopefully, that's enough of a catalyst to propel the community forward.
But hopefully now with that new, shall I say, passion, that real now want to get this language, I think hopefully like this. And if we really later get maybe a bit more help, people do proper recording, right? We'll do it maybe on a weekly basis or at least 2 or 3 times a week and get it online. But then I say you need resources, you need personnel, it will take your time. But let us start at this way, right? Because I think very important is people like you to come and give that support and that interest. And then it makes us even want to even go further and, you know, and do more.
And that was Martin Thesira, Kristang community leader. I think for me, there's such an urgency with which Martin spoke about preserving his community because he's on the front line. He's in those communities where there's still native speakers of Kristang language and he can see the decline happening in front of his eyes. There's also been those massive shifts to his community that's been happening over the past few decades. He mentioned mostly that land reclamation that's been happening across Malacca really since, you know, the 80s.
Yeah, don't get me started on the land reclamation. It is a shame. You know, this is a city that is, what, 600 or 700 years old, and, you know, Malaysia exists almost because of Malacca.
The seafaring is the cultural heart of Malacca.
Yeah, and you go to the river where the old port was built around in Malacca, and it's just this, like, I mean, there's a couple of like remnants of like the old fort that the Portuguese built, and but it's all just been so heavily developed. Like, you know, when Martin says that the coastline was pushed back, he's not talking about maybe like 50 or 100 meters. It's like a kilometer at least.
And there's nothing on that land.
No, it's like the land that they've reclaimed is so underutilized. They'll build one 20, 30 story kind of condo tower in one corner of the square kilometer that they might have reclaimed in one like phase, and then the rest of it, we walked through some of it to try and get to the shore, and you're just walking through like a field of long grass, and you're like, what's the ecological impact of this? Like, and but then like you also see these developments that have gone up, and they've got to like 20 stories, and they've been abandoned, and I'm like, what is going on, Malacca? So yeah. Anyway, but like that's not about the Kristang. But yeah, I think it's a shame though that he was talking about all of these festivals that used to happen in the sea that possibly no longer happen because how much the coastline has changed and how the communities have been disrupted because they've had to be resettled and moved, or like, you know, where the Kristang settlement is now maybe isn't where it always used to be, because that I think is kind of new land. And certainly when we walked about it going out to the Portuguese settlement, those condos or those houses, rather, the family homes only looked 30, 40 years old or something. And it's just a shame that like their old street and their old kind of like kampong, I guess, and now is irrelevant to them.
Yeah, because it's not connected to the ocean anymore. And there are so many barriers, I think, that Martin and this community are facing when you're trying to revive a language. Because I think it's really easy to think about reviving the language the same thing as learning a new language like if I was to learn French or if I was to learn Cantonese.
Right.
If I wanted to learn any of those two languages, there are so many resources of which I can draw upon.
Right.
There are textbooks, there are films, there's a lot of music available. There are so many ways that I can engage with that language. I could go to France if I wanted to. I could go to South China and do immersion if I wanted to. I could also pay teachers who have studied for years on the best way to learn a particular language. That doesn't really exist for the Christian community.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's what Martin was saying there, that, you know, it takes a lot of time and resources to prepare these teaching materials. Like,
and when we say teaching materials, sometimes we even just mean a poster of A to Z.
Yeah.
Of with Christian equivalents of apples, bananas, and cat.
Just basic vocab. Yeah, yeah. It's crazy. I mean, like, there is this. A dictionary has been published.
Yeah, there are some resources. I'm not saying there's nothing, but yeah, there's dictionaries. And I think these days, some digital resources have been created.
Yeah, and you can't learn a language by reading the dictionary.
No. And you need a community, because as he said, there's only perhaps 1,000 speakers left.
Right.
And so if you don't have anyone to practice speaking with, then it's difficult to get that language off the ground again.
And I think with speaking with Martin, that there was no shortage of ideas in his head that he had to kind of stimulate young people to learn the language. I mean, I think the idea of making a play about two fishermen kind of just chewing the fat with each other, you know, I think is a good way of doing it. I think it's particularly like comedy, I think is a good way of engaging people because at least it's light.
Well, we saw that a few episodes ago when we were talking to Ilya Katrinada about the Orang Lau communities.
Right.
And they were using theater to really get the message across about their community.
Yeah, and again, like using the tool of being able to record those spoken word exchanges, I think, you know, at least the language will never be lost in that sort of a way because it will go into an archive, hopefully.
Absolutely. So if you were to go to Malacca today, there's actually very little evidence of Portuguese Malacca left. Probably the most prominent are the remnants of the old Portuguese fort, and that's now called Afamosa. So back in the day, this fort would have been massive, but there's very, very little of it left. But well worth seeing if you are going to be in Malacca. And so the reason why there's not much evidence of Portuguese Malacca left is, well, because that empire didn't last for very long, and it was quickly replaced by another power.
As so often seems to be the case in this region.
Very much so. And so in the next episode, we're going to take a look at the next European player to enter the region. We're going to look at the Dutch. And the Dutch really, really did totally transform Southeast Asia in really profound ways, far more than Portugal ever did. And the impacts of the Dutch Empire, well, you can see that today, not just in Southeast Asia, but really across the world.
Yeah, I mean, fair to say that capitalism as we know it might have been started by the Dutch East India Company.
Precisely. And so if we just go back to our food of the day, our symbol, which is sambal. Sambal is something that all Malaysians know and love. It's quintessentially Malaysian in many ways, and yet it wouldn't be part of our culture had it not been for those Portuguese and Spanish traders who brought chili from Central and South America to Southeast Asia through historic trading around the 16th century. So every time you have a bite of sambal, remind yourself of where that came from.
No, it does start to paint a bigger picture of how all of this food that I've been introduced to came to be.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's what's amazing about Malaysia, that you can literally eat history off the plate.
It's a way to put it. Yeah. You take it for granted, don't you? Somebody puts a piece of food down in front of you, but you don't think about how chili's ended up in Southeast Asia. And not just in Southeast Asia, into the greater network of trade that was happening in Southeast Asia and the region. Absolutely. You know, think about how much food's in chili is in Thai food or Chinese even.
The more you think about it, the crazier it is because people associate Asia with chili so much.
Well, yes, and it wouldn't be the same if the Spanish hadn't gone across the Atlantic in search of the spices but gone in completely the wrong direction, bringing back spices to Europe.
Indeed. So in the next episode, we're going to continue our journey. We're going to look at Portuguese Malacca, our new European player in the region, the Dutch, and our Malacca rulers that have set up in Johor. And that episode we're calling Quay and the Unlikely Dutch Affair. And if you don't know what Quay is, well, that gives you even more reason to join us for the next episode.
How compelling.
So join us then for Sartay.
Okay.